I assume it's happened to some people sometimes, but in general, the language that God communicates by His Spirit, you know, something that He wants you to hear, to know, to respond to act on, to pray about, that language is a veiled language. And we can complain all we want about God not writing on people, but this is His choice.
Right.
That He has chosen to speak in veiled ways. This comes out kind of most clearly in, back to that Numbers 12 passage, you know, where, you know, Moses has followed God's instructions to call the elders together, the Spirit's fallen on them. Some of them didn't make the meeting. It fell on them anyway. They were out amongst the people. They prophesied out there. That's how everybody knew what was going on. They all get upset because Moses is our guy. Moses is our prophet. And they send poor Joshua to be their spokesperson to tell Moses, cut these people off, you know, shut them down. And that's when Moses said, "Are you jealous for my sake? You know, I long that all of God's people were prophets." But then, you know, Aaron and Miriam get all bent out of shape because, hey, you know, we've been doing this and now we're getting like no credit, no acknowledgement. And they start grumbling. I think it's just a fascinating Numbers 11 and 12. You know, in terms of the perception of people's psychology about how people work. You know, in Numbers 11, you have Moses in the depths of despair over how difficult it is to lead people and to lead them into something new, to lead them into real life, and he despairs about his own failure of that. So it's so relatable, so telling. But here at the beginning of Numbers 12, you have Aaron and Miriam, and they're hurt. They're hurt by the people's response and the kind of the elevation of Moses, and they're jealous and whatever else is going on. But you know how they attack Moses? His marriage. Wow. I just find that interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like, he married, you know, that woman, and I mean, that's how they attack him. And then, this is, you know, like a warning, you know, and then the Lord gets mad. He says, "We're going to have a little meeting together."
Wow, yeah.
And he asks Aaron and Miriam this really hard question: "Why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" He says, "When I speak to a prophet, I speak to him in visions and dreams and... But when I speak to Moses, I speak to him face to face, not in riddles."
So good.
See here, so Moses is different than everybody else, right? He gets face to face communication with God. Everybody else, prophets that God has, he speaks to them in riddles. Difference. Moses said, "There will be one like me who comes from his brothers."
Come on.
Jesus. We got Moses, Jesus, then everybody else. Jesus above Moses. Everybody else. So you and I, we aren't getting it face to face, clearly, and not in riddles. We're getting it in riddles. What are riddles? Things that have to be figured out. Things that are not as apparent as we would like them to be. Things that require sorting and sifting and interpreting and applying. And so, veiled language, this riddle-like communication that comes from God. You know, the main identifiers of this language biblically, you know, it's almost like that they're a reference to a whole category of communication, and that's dreams and visions. Joel mentions dreams and visions. Job mentions dreams and visions. Numbers 12. So we're talking about those are maybe like the two most outstanding examples of riddle-like communication. But that's not the only riddle-like communication. We have thoughts and impressions. We have experiences and circumstances. They would all fall under that similar kind of thing. But dreams and visions are the most outstanding examples of riddle-like communication. So let's take an example like dreams. Dreams are bizarre. Dreams are from as best that we can understand, you know, from, and there's been a lot of research poured into dreams in the last 50 years, and it seems the general consensus is that our capacity as human beings to dream is tied up with the subconscious and its ability to be refreshed. So your dreams are a process that is being utilized by your subconscious to cleanse things out of your life. So all those dreams that you have about showing up for a test naked, or, you know, whatever the imagery is of the dream that we tend to have repetitively in our life, this is, if I could put it as blunt as this is the toilet bowl of the subconscious flushing away.
Revelation.
You know, some things are hard to flush away. And so they happen again and again and again. So, a system that is meant to take things out of your life, to refresh or to cleanse your life, God chooses to put in your life. So it's kind of like you come over to my house, you say, David, I'm really thirsty. Could you get me a cup of water? And I scoop it out of the toilet and I say, here you go.
Hallelujah.
And you go, ooh. That's what it's like. Huh? Yeah, I've done that to you? That's not true. Now, that should have been true, especially after you made me pick up dog poop. But it's not true. Yeah. So the fact that God chooses a vehicle He created for elimination in your life to bring something to your life, this is an interesting choice. I'm just saying to you that both are by God's design, and it's interesting. Because it immediately puts dreams in the categories of, is that out or in? And most, here's what statistics say. People have 6 to 7 dream episodes in their sleep at night. I don't know about you. I don't remember. I remember vividly one from last night. But I'm sure, like most dreams, it's to be shrugged off. And that's ultimately how you'll discover a dream that's supposed to come in, is it won't be able to shrug off. Like, some dreams just have a weight to them. They won't go away. Mm-hmm. Most, you just toss the bucket out and say, well, I don't know what that was. That was weird. And who knows what my subconscious is doing. But some just want to get in there. But even so, a dream that has weight to it, and you think, maybe there's something here to this dream. Now it has to be figured out.
Right.
And it seems as though, because the subconscious is involved, that dreams are heavily weighted towards emotional language, like the emotion of it, the how we perceive. But and not to say that details are unimportant, but they often are representative. Like, you know, that someone who's an authority figure or beloved or trusted appears in your dream, and, you know, possibly are they, because of how you feel towards them, are they representing the God part of this message, you know, like, who knows, right? But here's an example, like, of how this works is that, you know, Gideon, he has this, you know, the story of Gideon. He's got to, you know, try to liberate Israel, and he can only use, you know, a few people to do it, and he's understandably, like, anxiety-ridden about it. And God says, well, if you're so worried about it, go down, it's the middle of the night, go down and listen to what they're saying in the, you know, camp of your enemy. So he sneaks down there, and he comes up next to a tent, and one guy wakes up and tells his friend, I just had the worst dream. A big round barley loaf rolled down the hill and squashed our tent. Now that's a dream. Like, that is a dream right there. The big loaf of bread bounced down the hill and squashed the tent.
Of course. course, everyone knows what that means.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, it can only mean one thing, Gideon says. You know, we're going to win. You know, Israel, I mean, that's what the friend tells the, you know, like, we're going to get crushed in this battle. And like Gideon goes, wow, I'm encouraged. You know, like, the big round barley loaf encouraged me. Riddle-like communication.
Wow.
Right? Images, visions. We, you know, we'd love them to be just unveiled reality, you know, like seeing the future or whatever. Very rarely. They are, again, like, what does that mean? What is that? My vision of the necklace. What is that? Why am I seeing it? What does it represent? It has to be, there's a riddle to it that has to be unfolded. And our great confidence is that if God is communicating, that He's going to help us unfold the riddle of it, or as much as we need to. Because, you know, the first part of that unfolding is I got to interpret what it is that I'm seeing or hearing or experiencing or feeling. And then having interpreted it, I have to now make a decision about what does God want me to do with that? Is this simply to inform my prayers? Is this to stimulate my, you know, having a conversation? But it's that communication of just the expectation. So for me, being such a reader and, you know, words and all of that, of course, what I think happens is that God develops a unique vocabulary with each of us. It's not the same. So I shouldn't have been surprised. I'd never see God ride on anybody. Like I think that He tends to develop a very specific vocabulary with you, and like anything that involves intimacy, over time you get shortcuts in a vocabulary with someone you know very well. That's what initially it's like, you know, our grandchildren. We have a couple of grandsons who are gonna, you know, one's one and one's going to turn one, and so language, they're on the cusp of language, and man, it's all a struggle, you know, getting that first word and then putting words together and all that kind of stuff. And it's wow, but you know, then Nancy and I've been married for 41 years. Thank you, honey, for that one. 41, and you know, there's a lot of shortcuts in our communication. Right, so you know, so for me, I thought, wow, you know, words, no, I see pictures, I have physical sensations. I mean, just not at all in my comfort zone. I mean, but that's over time you recognize, well, that's how the Lord taps on my life, and not that He couldn't do it in other ways, you know. I've had an occasional dream, but in general, over time, there'll be a consistency. There'll be a consistency that enables kind of a more rapid movement from interpretation to application in those things. Okay? All right. Number 5. Embracing the cost of maturity. You got to pay the price for growing up. And nobody can do it for you. And this is part of our frustration with spiritual gifts in general, that we would like them to come in a mature form. Like just drop on us and wow. You know, we can use them. But they don't happen like that. They are spiritually sourced abilities and callings and qualities, and they have to be grown. They have to be developed. And we have to pay the price for that development. Some of the things that have to do with prophecy have been really unhelpful for paying the price. What happens is that in our growing up, of course, we don't do everything right. We don't handle everything well. Some things we make a mess of. But if you're doing that with prophecy, because God's on, you know, like it's like gifts with a check mark. You know, it's like gifts with trump cards on them. You know, like suddenly it's like God says. So that you've just moved totally out of, well, whatever, you know, if you're a teacher, it's still you saying it, even if you're claiming some teaching that's not true. And, you know, but what prophecy is like, wow, God's like on the line. And so it's really an unhelpful model, this idea that if you're going to prophesy, that you prophesy in such a way that imposes and kind of claims something that is not necessarily true. So, thus saith the Lord. You know, that model of, I'm just speaking on God's behalf and that's the way it ought to be done. Well, I think it could be helpfully done that way if that is in fact what's happening.
Right.
But if you're in the process of growth and you're a mixture of something and you're doing it that way, you're not being helpful. You're making somebody else pay the price of your growing up. You've just said, thus saith the Lord, and it might be half the Lord and half you or none of the Lord, and they just now have landed on them and they have to decide, are you an absolute idiot or are you, you know, the voice piece of God? And that's just completely unfair.
It is unfair.
It is. It's just completely unfair. So the best way, rather than kind of impose or control, you know, is to offer and ask. You want to learn to pay the price for listening to God is, I think I have something, and so I offer to them. Does this mean anything to you? Do you have a necklace? You know, like, offer and ask. Like, I've gone up to strangers that I felt I had a word for. I've had some painful lessons of maturity. I've had some of those, wow, was that God? You know, I went up to some stranger and told them something, and boo-hoo-hoo, boo-hoo-hoo, and we had this wonderful follow-up conversation, and wasn't that fantastic? And I've had some of the most embarrassing moments of my life going up to somebody and saying something that was completely off. But what's mitigated that embarrassment and that, for them at least, if not for me, was offering and asking versus trying to impose and pronounce, right? And here's the great thing about it. I have something that's God, you can't lessen the power of.
Wow. Yeah.
Really. Yeah. You can't. It's like you can be as humble, I don't know if this means anything, and then kaboom! You know, it's like, it's really God, and it really has weight, and it doesn't matter how humbly or deferentially you offered it, kaboom! And it doesn't matter how much you build it up. We used to call it in the Kansas City days, that people added hamburger helper to their prophecy. It wasn't really meat, it was something, but it made it seem like more than it was. So no matter how vehemently you say, thus saith the Lord, if it's not the Lord, it's going to... So there's no downside to this, what I'm saying. Is, you know, like, you really got something going from the Lord to give someone? It won't take away from it to act like, I don't know, you know, what do you think? Okay. The cost of maturity. No presuming, no imposing. Testing the spirits. This is the one clear place in the New Testament where we're given some kind of filtering key about how to tell something that's come from God from something that hasn't come from God. And I don't know if images help you, but the image I have in my mind is the way that water comes into our house. You know, for us in the high desert, you know, we have they take groundwater, or they take, you know, the concrete river, the aqueduct that comes from the Sierras. They take water out of that. It goes into treatment plants. You know, first of all, initially when the water is taken from its source, like out of the aqueduct, there's a lot of fish in there, you know. There's a lot of tumbleweeds. There's a lot of car tires. There's a lot of debris in there. First, you got to get the big parts out first. So there's some kind of, you know, screen in the intake that is, you know, filtering out the big logs and the debris and that kind of stuff. And then gradually, you know, as the process goes on, there's a smaller and smaller filtering of things. So I always imagine 1 John 4 talking about like a series of screens. You know, here's some of the screens that are in place that help us to capture the things that can't be God. Okay, so are you familiar with the 1 John? Let me just read it for us just so we're on the same page together. 1 John 4. John says, "Dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." Let me stop for a second and say that John is using the word spirit here. You know, spirit can be used both in Greek and Hebrew. The idea of spirit means breath or wind or in the case of God, creation, even disembodied beings, personalities, mm-hmm. right? So there's this wide range in the use of those words, of from everything from, you know, this idea of something that comes from the center of your life that you breathe in or breathe out, to an actual person who doesn't have physical form. So John is using here in 1 John 4 the non-personal way of speaking of spirit. So he's not talking about some personality, some demon or angel that you're testing. He's talking about testing the spirit of something, where it comes from, the center of it. What's at the center of it? That's really critical to know where it's from. Like, where does what's the center of this? So the very first thing that John says about, you know, and he says this, you need to do this because many false prophets are in the world. Many people are speaking things as coming from the center of God's heart or mind or will that are not that. And so they need to be caught in the screens and filtered out. So here's the first screen that he throws up in 1 John. This is how you can recognize the Spirit of God. Every spirit that acknowledges that Jesus has come in the flesh is from God. But every spirit that does not acknowledge Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard is coming, and even now is already in the world. Mm-hmm. So the first screen is this confession, this center that Jesus has come in the flesh. Now, this requires a little unpacking because as much as I've traveled and spoken about things prophetic, I've had countless conversations with someone afterwards who comes up and looks at me really seriously and says, "Confess that Jesus Christ came in the flesh." They think that my verbal acknowledging of that is somehow like the application of this test. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good that they discover that I'm an Orthodox Christian, but what he's talking about is something very, very particular to what was going on in the first century. And that has to do with something called Gnosticism. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge. And Gnosticism was a prevailing kind of perspective that it invaded religion and philosophy, that basically said that the key to life was secret gnosis, secret knowledge, and the access to that knowledge would elevate your life, kind of give you the life that you were meant to have. So John is saying something very particular here. He's saying that the life that you're meant to have comes from the person and the work and the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, not some secret bit of information. It must confess that life comes from Jesus,
right,
identifying with us our broken humanity, giving his life for our brokenness, and being raised for our redemption. So this idea, you know, in the first century there would have been Gnostic Christians who would have denied that Jesus was material at all, that was like irrelevant, that he came to impart secret information, special knowledge, and that special knowledge was saving to you. And so John is saying it's not knowledge that's saving, mm-hmm, it's Jesus that's saving.
Come on.
And so this is very, very important when it comes to prophecy, because prophecy is dealing with knowledge and can be offered as special knowledge that's redemptive. And it is as much a problem today as it was in the first century. I think that, you know, most of kind of the self-help books that you'd find in Barnes & Noble or on Amazon are peddling an idea that this special information is going to be saving in your life. I think that Christians peddle this. I appreciate people who have faith and want healing for others, but it's not a word of knowledge that produces healing. So I don't say, hey, you got this and you're healed. It's Jesus that heals.
Of course.
You see, the subtle slope of attaching to information this special power, the power of life, that's deadly. That's Gnosticism. And John is saying the first filter that we filter out is anything that's not coming from a core, that Jesus is our redemptive key. He's our redemptive one. That it's relationship and knowing him that is saving, and information serves that, of course, but it doesn't substitute that. And that's why he says, and this is so important that you know, I'm sure you all know this already, but Antichrist in the Greek does not mean against Christ.
No.
Like this is against, that's fairly easy to identify, the things that are absolutely hate Jesus. Anti in Greek means instead of, in place of. Antichrist means the one that wants to take the place of Jesus. And this idea that somehow special knowledge will do it wants to take the place of Jesus. And John says that should be rejected as not the Spirit of God, but the spirit of falsehood. It's coming from a false place. It needs to be filtered out. And secondly, he says, you dear children are from God and have overcome them. He's talking about, you know, these false prophets in the world. You've overcome them because the one who's in you is greater than the one who's in the world. They are from the world and therefore speak from the viewpoint of the world, and the world listens to them. There's the second filter, the viewpoint of the world. Now we would all have to decide what that is. What's the viewpoint of the world? But having some idea about that ought to be helpful. So something, for instance, that would come towards me, that would appeal to my pride, that would flatter me, or, I mean, at the height of, you know, our traveling in Kansas City, we attended a meeting, you and I, attended a meeting where the nations of the world were being handed out.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you're going to be the apostle of India. And I mean, that's kind of flattering, right? Wow, God would have me be like, you know. But if I had any sense of the viewpoint of the world, I'd probably be suspicious of that. Had a guy, we once had a meeting in Kansas City. We had a meeting, this other Pentecostal prophetic, well-known prophetic guy comes in, and we're talking, and he says to me, he starts prophesying to me how God was going to give me a Rolls Royce and a Rolex and all of that, and all the while I'm just going like this to him, you know, like in my heart I'm just thinking, like, I'm a Ronald Sider guy, I don't even know what you're talking about. For someone that might be attractive, but it's attractive in a worldly way. And I'm uninterested. Like you might think, oh, you missed out on a chance, you know, opportunity for a blessing. No. I was just, had my screens in place. Like, I had gotten caught up in when we lived in England. It was this famous thing that an Anglican vicar, and I was doing most of my traveling and teaching in Anglican churches, but an Anglican vicar, I don't know how old they were, maybe he was in his late 30s or early 40s, but he felt like the Lord had told him his wife was going to die and he was to marry her best friend. She wasn't sick. It went, you know, got on all the, you know, the tabloid, you know, like, it became a big story in England. This guy has told his church, told his wife's preparing to die. She's getting her stuff in order, right? Like, so I had some people who knew this guy, and they said, would you call him and talk to him, you know? And so I tried to call him. He wouldn't talk to me. What would I have said? Your desire to have her best friend as your wife is a worldly, ugly thing. And it is twisted. Whatever you think you heard should have been filtered out by the worldliness of the message. No matter how you thought, wow, this is supernatural, you know. Just sad. They got divorced. She's still alive. Yeah. Okay. Second one. The third one. We are from God. Whoever knows God listens to us. I love this one. But whoever is not from God does not listen to us. This is how we recognize the spirit of truth and the spirit of falsehood. This is either the most arrogant statement ever written down, or it's true. We are from God. Whoever is from God listens to us. Who's the we? It's the apostles. So there is a claim for apostolic authority that overrules individual kind of revelation. So the Bible, what are the criterion for the biblical books? In the Old Testament is that they have to be attached to a prophetic voice. So you have the prophet in the Old Testament, and the criteria for the New Testament books, they have to be attached to apostolic authority, that they're the work of an apostle. So, that's the word. It has to listen to us. And so there's this filter of, is it contradicting? Is it, you know, obviously some things would be clear, other things not as clear. But the things that would be clear ought to be, they ought to be clear, that we ought to know them. I hear explanations for things sometimes that just break my heart. You know, that people are trying to give explanation for some experience or thing that's happened to them or is happening to others, and their explanation is so profoundly unbiblical. It's so profoundly false. Like during the height of Toronto days, I heard someone teach that the reason why God was laying out people for long periods of time and the Spirit was kind of smothering them is that the Holy Spirit was lonely for Jesus who's in heaven and just trying to get close to the Jesus in you.
That's silly.
I thought, well, that's like the worst theology I ever heard. That's someone who doesn't know much about the idea of God biblically. I mean, you know, it's just like crazy, right? So our understandings, our perspectives, even our interpretation of things has to be run through. We've got to listen. We have to listen. First to the Word, and then to what we perceive to be the Spirit. And again, there'll be a lot of things that I don't know, the Scripture doesn't speak to that, or here's how, so the waters flowed, right? We got the car tires and the dead bodies out on the first pass through. And then we passed through the viewpoint of the world and we got the dead squirrels and the, you know, the big pine cones out. And now we're moving through the filter of the word and, wow, something's passed through and we have to decide, you know, like, is that a stone or is that a seed? Like, is that like a little rock or is that like a seed that's going to bear fruit? What are you, how are you going to find out? You got to plant it. You know, some things will pass through. Now I got to do something to find out. Is this, so I offer and I ask. It's like, what do you think? You know? The last thing, the fourth thing, though, just to, again, underline the point we started with. But where does it go from there? It says, dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. So the final filter is love. Paul will say in 1 Corinthians 14 that, you know, prophetic words are for strength, comfort, and encouragement. That's what they're meant to impart. And so that we ought to take that seriously. You know, I think it could be loving. You know, certainly a parent sometimes has to scare their child, like, of the consequent, you know, like, do not run into the street. This is what could happen. You know, maybe there's, I mean, I would be careful about that, but there's, you know, I'm not saying that strength, comfort, and encouragement couldn't be found in confrontation or challenge, but in general, I think that this, again, the filter is love, you know. Carl, you were telling me about, you know, instances, and I remember this, you know, some prophetic person would say, oh, I dealt with this not that long ago. I had some person in my church come and make an accusation of child abuse against one of our pastors.
Wow.
And there was no evidence. It wasn't like she saw something. She had a dream. And her expectation was I was going to fire, you know, deal with this, discipline this person based on this accusation. A person who I have intimate knowledge of their family relationships and what a loving, kind of righteous father and husband he is. I just think, oh gosh, you know, like, you know, what was the first break on that was, you know, love. Now again, abusers can be great at hiding, you know. So I had a little conversation with his daughter. Nobody knew about it. Nobody wasn't like I called her in and has anybody been touching you inappropriately? I just had a conversation with her where I just kind of, hey, how's it going? You know, like asked different questions, just see if anything would flag, anything would kind of register that said, this is a person under pressure. This is a person who's dealing with things at a deeper level, even if they're unwilling to show that. And you know, it's just like, oh gosh, what are we doing? Sometimes a group of people that have a lot of interest in prophecy, it becomes like a shooting gallery. I mean, they're bouncing off walls and people get hurt.
Yeah.
People get hurt. So love, you know, if you aren't loving God, loving others, you don't know God. You don't know his voice. You don't know what's really going on. You better holster your gun.
That's good.
Okay. Hope this is helpful.
Yep.
So good.
Feeling the right kind of pressure. This is, I'm sure you know this. Pressure and prophecy have a similar relationship to desire and prophecy. pressure when it comes to your life and hearing from God for you, it's the last thing you need. It's unfortunate that most people only really want to hear from God about their life or direction when they're in crisis.
Right.
That's really unfortunate, because that's like the worst time for you to hear from God. You're under such pressure. What happens under that pressure? That pressure produces a desire to be out from under it, a desire for relief, a desire to be free from pain, whatever, and that desire will be distorting. So personal pressure to hear from God when you're in crisis is not a helpful... It's like, wow, I should have heard from Him when I was not under pressure. Like... So it's just a fact. So, it doesn't make any less necessary to hear from God when we're under pressure. It just means that we need to have the wisdom to know, wow, this is a really vulnerable place, and I got to be really careful what I think the Lord is saying under this kind of pressure. Because a lot of people under crisis and pressure will believe really disastrous things that they think God is telling them. And it will really, talk about multiplying pain. Talk about kind of making a crisis worse is to have some sense of a word from God that you got for that crisis that's not God at all. That's that. So what does that say? That says, wow, just like that clarity cost thing, like those times when things are like, there's room, it's like, I really need to open my heart to hear from God about the future.
Right.
2 years ago, or three now, 3 years ago, I'm not even 60 yet. I'm well, and I just hear so clearly from God, it's time to transition your leadership to the next generation. And I spoke to good friends about it. They said, "No, you don't want to. You're not even 60 yet. You have 15 more years. You'll regret this. You'll end up and." No, it was so clear to me. But there was no pressure to do it. It was just so clear to me. And so I began the process. And at the very end of the process, it was like, well, guess what? You have a cancer diagnosis that says that you're not gonna live more than, a couple of years. Well, whether that happens or not, I don't know. But I do know that I was really glad I got that word about transition before I had the diagnosis. You know what I mean? Like, oh no, I got to transition to this church. Like, here, you have it. I'm so glad. Really. Like, so glad. Hear from God now.
Hear from God now. That's a good word.
About your life. Get it confirmed by others that you love and trust and can say, I think that is the Lord, Here, part of the clarity cost thing is, I'm the only one that believes it. Oof. Wow. You need to have massive clarity to be the only one that believes something and reject the counsel of your friends or mentors or people who love you are telling you, don't do it. You just need to have visible visitation from an angel or something. And even then, let's check your medication. It's like, I know people, prominent people, who believe something so deeply at the core, like something like that, what I'm telling you, something that they alone believe against everyone else because of something, some experience, and it's false. It's false. It's like, get back up. The hard things, the personal things, get back up. Get people who say, I can see it. I'm with you. Otherwise, just a lot of danger there. Now, here's the interesting thing about pressure. Pressure on you, for you, bad. Pressure on you, for others, good. There's some things that God wants to bring through your life for other people that will never happen without pressure.
Right.
Like you, in other words, you need to be pressed to be listening to do something for them. speak or act on God's behalf, pray at His leading. So what I always tell people who come to me and say, man, I'm a prophet. Not that many people do that anymore, but they used to. And people do come to me and say, I've got these, you know, revelations happening to me. What should I do? The first thing that I want them to do is get in the trenches with people. Mm-hmm. I want them to join the prayer ministry. I want them to have people in front of them regularly who are saying, well, I'm in need, I'm hurting, this is going on in my life. And then you apply that discipline. Like, I don't know this person, I'm just meeting them, they're telling me a little bit about their need. But rather than respond with my best effort and my nicest words, I'm going to stop and say, Lord, do you have something that you want to say? I'm going to put myself under that pressure and that discipline, their need, this moment, and say, God, speak through me.
That's good.
You need that. Mm-hmm. For others, that will cause things to flow. Like, again, you have to pay the price. You have to offer and ask. You have to, you know, have confidence and dependence and not pride and insecurity. You have to negotiate the road, but that pressure will be really helpful. Like, really helpful to stand in that place consistently with people who need some prayer, need God to work in their life, and they're asking you to be part of that, and you restrain your own stuff and say, God, is there something you would give through me? Because maybe some of my stuff is what you want me to give them, but if there's something that you want me to pass on, I'm here, I'm listening, I'm participating. That's a great pressure to have consistently in our life. Lastly, Jesus says in Matthew 7, you know, that the test is fruit. Watch out for false prophets, Jesus says. They come to you in sheep's clothing. In other words, they can't, it's not outward appearance, it's not how they come across that will be the indication. But inwardly, they are ferocious wolves. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit you will recognize them. That ultimately it's about fruit. So the growth curve, you know, on one side of it, on our side as participants, of putting ourselves in that place of restraint and saying, God, you know, lead me in this interaction or this opportunity with others, lead me. But part of what will happen is I need to see the fruit of that. Like, is that a seed or a pebble that I'm offering? And it won't simply be their response in the moment. If I could, I've you know, heard people talk about this. Wow, I didn't know about the word, but wow, when they burst out in tears when I gave it, I knew it was God. Well, that could be. That could be some of the beginning evidence of that.
Right.
But not necessarily. Because the fruit will be the impact of it. The fruit will be what is produced by it. And so we just have to be watching. Like, that's why it's so helpful. I spent some years with different prophetic people traveling all over, and you know, you kind of parachute in some place and a bunch of words are fired off and people are, you know, maybe impressed or not impressed by that, and then off you go and you never know. Like, those people, it's such a bad, it's bad for them, it's bad for the people it happens to. And you know, what is so helpful is over time you be able to see what a word means and what a word does. Like, and again, you know, most words that we would offer or prayers we would offer somebody, they don't change everything. Some do. You're a voice and not an echo. Some Some do change everything, but some are just contributing to something. So it's not like we're looking for absolute transformation, but we're looking for evidence of impact. That will encourage us, and obviously that is the thing that we're looking for and what comes towards us. And I have to say, having, you know, I'll just go back to this point and then we'll have opportunity for some discussion or questions, but I, you know, being around really gifted people and seeing what goes wrong in terms of identity and character on the one hand, and in terms of kind of biblical understanding on the other, that it goes really wrong. And so the bad fruit is not just someone got an errant word. You know, that's a struggle. Like, this person told me this, it wasn't true at all. You know, like, okay, now I got to process that. You know, my relationship with them or lack of one, and, you know, the fact that I live in a world where I got to navigate this minefield of people dropping bombs on you that aren't true. But here's the bad fruit. The bad fruit ultimately is loss of faith. Mm. Is the undermining of the very thing that it was meant to serve, which is that loving, trust-filled relationship with God. And so, you know, when the fruit of something is, over time, lots of people with less faith or no faith, then you got to say that's not God. That's not God.
Wow.
And when someone's life, you know, I'm not saying that we all need to be perfect, because Lord knows we're not. But we got to be honest. And we got to be real. And when that doesn't exist, you know, like, then I just have to say, I'm sorry if I'm stepping on anyone's toes, but I don't know how anyone can listen to virtual prophets. People they have no relationship with, never seen up close, don't know how they live, what their family's like. I don't know how that's, you know, we live in this is a unique time in history of humanity, where you can have people on the internet or people on television or whatever that are being like a virtual prophet to you, and you don't have any way at all to examine their life. None. And I just think it's a disastrous link up. And I, you know, even giving grace for people who are desperate and maybe they don't have anybody, you know, all of that, but to be able to kind of witness how someone really is as part of the factoring in of what is the fruit of what I'm receiving from them, my gosh, Jesus could not have fathomed that in St. John 10, my sheep follow me because they hear my voice, that he would end up with a bunch of sheep that follow a virtual voice, not even a real one, not even a present one, not even a one that we know anything really about. So that's kind of a bummer way to end, but that's all I got. So I believe it strongly.
I do too.
Anybody got any questions, anything you want to ask? Because we could do, yes, fire away.
Even if it's a really great prophetic word, people have to respond. So sometimes you don't see any fruit. I don't even know what the question is in that, except for that. You can't really beat yourself up all the time when people don't move forward, right?
Yeah, absolutely right.
Their responsibility.
That's absolutely right. There's some, so it's not just simply a matter of there was impact, there was not, or you know, it was bad impact. Sometimes the no impact thing, what do you do with that? And I tend to set those on the shelf. Because there may not be any impact now, but there may be later. And there may not be any impact now, and maybe later I recognize, oh, that probably wasn't on target, you know. It's the same way I feel about some dreams that come through that have weight to them, but I can't figure them out. And I don't just throw them away. I set them on the shelf. I was like, I don't know about that. It's fascinating because God is a parent, you know? Like, I love this about God. It's like, then when that thing the dream was about happens, he'll go, remember that dream I gave you? This was this thing that I'm... Oh, okay, I can pick it up now off the shelf. It's like, I didn't know what to do with that. It's, you know, my fault, you know, my bad, whatever. But now I can take it off the shelf. There is a shelf, so it's not just... And so you're right, like somebody doesn't respond at all, doesn't mean that you got to put it on the shelf. So you can't carry it. It can't be like, oh, now I need to feel bad because I missed it. I just have it on the shelf. I don't know. Maybe I'll know about that later. Right. Maybe I won't. Yes.
Just to carry the thought further, certainly you said that eagerly seeking an outcome can
warp it. Yeah.
Warp things. Where does our responsibility then extend to as in bringing a prophetic word in terms of is my job to bring the word and where it lands and how it lands? Or how much, you know, where lies my responsibility and how do I walk that out so that it doesn't either hinder me or I get caught up in something that isn't mine to hang on to?
Yes. So the way that I would understand that is that if I'm listening and I'm receiving something that's come from the Lord, and then I'm trying to respond to that and act or speak or pray in regards to what I've received, then that's what I need to have eager desire to do, to both receive and to respond. What I can't, what I got to keep my hands off of is what my responding and my activity or my prayer produces. That's what I got to take my hands off of. In other words, if I think, and then, like this it would not be like, okay, you know, I feel like this leader in something, they're really off base. And so what I really want them to do is change. And so I think I have this understanding or correction for them. But what I really want is that change rather than simply respond lovingly to what God's giving me and respond lovingly to them. I think that I'm in danger because I'm after that the outcome, and I'm in danger of the way that happens actually frustrating the outcome. So I would agree, yes, you kind of leave it to like, do I want them to change? You bet. Do I want things to be different? I do. But my desire is focused on both the receiving and the responding, and I am leaving what actually happens to that, as long as it's, again, guarded by love. I'm leaving that to them and to the Lord, because I can't do more than that. I can't impose it. I can't control them. I have to leave it to them and to the Lord. You know, I don't know if I'm exactly understanding what the question is, but that's how I feel about it.
I guess part of it is sometimes trying to decide, is the Lord revealing this to me for prayer, to intercede, or
yes.
Is there a step further to bring the word? And once the word is delivered, then am I like, I'm done?
Yes.
Or, you know, do I continue to pray into that? Or, I mean, because at some point, what people do or don't do with the word can have a real impact on me if I let it.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I think that you have to let it go, that your general approach would be to let it go, because it's like having too many lines in the water fishing or something. Like, I can only have so many lines. So with exceptions, if the Lord wouldn't let me let it go, that I continue to pray, that it seems to me that I let it go. Now, that's a very good question about, do I pray or do I do something with it? And to me, I'd always start with the prayer and see if that relieved it. You know what I mean? Like, I got this, I got this thing, a concern. And so I pray. Did I feel relieved in that prayer? Or is that not enough? And now I'm on to, I'm looking for an opportunity to offer to ask. And And now in a lot of times, it's like the Lord, I really do trust the Lord to make a way for that. Like, I want to offer to ask what I have, but I also want the Lord to orchestrate that I don't just make that happen. You know, that gives me confidence. Like, oh, we weren't supposed to be sitting next to each other, but we are. Hey, I was praying for you. What does this mean anything to you? Like, I mean, to me, I just have so much more confidence in that way than I, again, impose control of the situation. And you're right, if you hang on to what happens from, I mean, this is the life of a pastor. If I hang on to, did my message produce the fruit that I desired to produce in their life, and I have a conversation 10 minutes after I just gave a message, and I said what, they tell me how meaningful it was, and I asked them what parts were meaningful to, and they can't remember a bit of it, then if I hold on to that, I'm just going down, you know, like, I'm just, the submarine is headed to the bottom of the floor. I got to let go of it. It's like you and God. I did my part as best I could. If there's more for me to do, I want to do that too, but I got to let it go. Anybody else? Yes.
More for a perspective than a specific answer to a specific question, because it's kind of complicated, I think. But on the one hand, I've heard stories about people who moved in the prophetic, and you know, maybe that was even their ministry. They're sort of, this is what I do. And the Lord would move through them and minister through people prophetically, and they had problems in their personal life with sin and various things like that. And then there's another school of thought that just says, you know, for the Lord to use you, you can easily block that use by having some level of sin in your life. So what is your perspective on the tension between what's going on in people's personal lives and the Lord using them in ministry prophetically?
Yeah. You know, the question is about, you know, like you know, people can be used mightily and they've got real issues in their life, sin in their life, brokenness in their life, and yet, you know, the other perspective is like that would block, you know, God working. When it comes to gifting, and maybe especially when it comes to prophecy, that it's like the gifts are without repentance. You know, it's like it's they're not taken back. They're not restricted. And you can be in a whole lot of bad stuff in your life and still operate. But does it mean that it's going to have the lasting ministerial effect? And I don't think so. I think there's loss. There's loss in the brokenness. But I don't think that it's true that the gifting is not still in operation, because I've just seen too much of it.
Right.
I mean, you know, we're a vineyard. Our history is colored by people like Lonnie and others who had real brokenness in their life, but their gifting still contributed something, you know. And that's a mystery. Nancy and I were talking last night about a dear prophetic friend no longer living, but we were in a meeting that they came into and described, you know, like the exposure and the fall of someone in the room in a very detailed way, and it was them. Months later, it was them.
Hello?
Yeah.
So gift and character, you wish that the bigger the gift, the better the character.
You'd hope so.
But honestly, with prophecy, because I think of some of the things we're talking about, some of the issues of it being veiled, and I think that the desperation, the eager desire part, you know, we could substitute desperation. Like nothing is working, and I desperately need this. But I think that sometimes in really broken people's lives, they have a more fertile ground for that. And so the prophetic flower, even in the midst of just terrible brokenness. And so this gift kind of advances alongside this life not you know, not together, not working. And it's a mystery, I have to say, but I've seen it over and over again. And I long for really healthy, functional people to be more prophetic. I long for it. But, and I'm hopeful for it because I believe it's for everybody. I believe it's not like, wow, that's a special case. You like really are led by the Spirit. I just don't think that's supposed to be true. I think we're all supposed to be that at some capacity. But it seems that people who have a high capacity to kind of are often how are dealing with real, real brokenness inside. Yeah. We're ready?
Yeah.
Cool.
I have a question.
Oh, sorry. Yes, please.
You're talking about pressure and trying to hear in the midst of pressure.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if it's like the apostles in the boat with Jesus and the storm, Lord, don't you care that we're perishing? He wakes up. We need to develop an intimacy with the Lord so that we can hear him even in the storm. Or is it wiser to rely on, say, the body of Christ alongside of us?
Yeah.
I'm going to remain in the storm and hear from them.
So first I would say that when we're under pressure or crisis, that there's no restriction on us crying out to God, right? Which is how I would more interpret the storm in the boat. There's no, I'm not at all saying that, well, you should limit. But honestly, when we're in a crisis, we tend to even need others to pray for us. Like, if the crisis is big enough, honestly, it'll take your breath away. It'll take your ability to pray away. And so we do really need people to step in for us. But very specifically in terms of hearing from God like the answer, and I think you're right. I think that a mature person knowing that, you know, that they're not firing off their first flare to heaven under crisis. A mature person being in crisis again and again and would have a greater capacity to hear from God under that pressure than someone who'd never done it. So I totally agree that it's not like that is impossible for you to hear from God, but you would have to be fairly disciplined in how you were receiving it to not let that pressure have distorted things. So you would have a maturity that was being pretty careful with what I'm hearing and able to test it along, you know, kind of a number of levels. And I agree that should be the goal, that we have that kind of maturity that would enable us to do that. But I would still think that we would need others no matter what.
That's good. That,
and the bigger the crisis, probably the more that we need others.
Yeah.